It's the Criterion. It's the Criterion. 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 And Project.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Criterion Project. This is the show where we talk about what is playing on the Criterion channel, and we have a lot of fun doing it. I'm film critic Rachel Wagner, and Conrado's here.
Yes, he is, as always. Yes.
And we have a very special guest today. We have screenwriter Topher Payne is here. Thank you so much, Topher, for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Well, since you are new to our podcast, you've been on the Hallmarkies podcast, my other podcast before, several times. But why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
I am a Atlanta-based screenwriter and playwright, originally from Mississippi. For the past year, since we took a little break from making TV and movies and plays, I've really been best known for taking care of a whole bunch of animals around my house and doing some gardening and watching a lot of movies.
Great.
Yes. And you have written several Hallmark movies, is how we first became friends and got to know each other.
Yeah, I just finished my sixth Hallmark movie.
Wow.
And we should be going into production on that soon.
Oh, that's very exciting. Can you tell if it's a Christmas movie?
It is not a Christmas movie. Oh. It is a royal romance.
Oh, appropriate this conversation.
Yeah, a young American woman falls for a royal from a mysterious European country. And
yes.
Not to spoil anything, but things work out okay for
that. That sounds great. I'm very excited. All right. Well, what we like to do to start out our show is talk about what we've been watching on the Criterion channel or anything else that we feel like talking about. So, Conrado, why don't you start what you've been watching?
Yeah, so the Arab American Museum, they made available a number of films by a Palestinian director called Elia Suleiman, who I wanted to see his movies for a long time, but they weren't easy to find. So it was great because they were available for free, and they will be available until May 31st, which I think it's sadly not going to be enough time for people listening to this to take advantage of it. But If you ever see his films available, I would recommend them because I've watched two out of the four that are now up and they were both really good. One of them is called The Time That Remains, and this is from 2009. And it's kind of like a somewhat autobiographical story about him growing up in Palestine. And it kind of begins in 1948 during the war that, you know, established the State of Israel. And then it goes like into the 70s and 80s, and then what was then in 2009, contemporary times, kind of like just life in Nazareth, which is where he's from. And what's interesting and exciting to me is that it's not necessarily the kind of movie you would expect when someone tells you, like, you know, a serious Palestinian director. We kind of think of, like, you know, very serious heroin drama, but this is kind of like a, you know, it's very clear-eyed in the politics and what it has to say and talking about the what life is like there. But it's also very warm and beautiful story about his family and his life. And it's kind of like his childhood. And, you know, it's kind of like this very, to me, you know, Rachel, that I really love when someone mixes comedy and drama and mixes the serious and the warm and the funny. And that is very much present in that movie. I really loved it. And then his most recent movie from 2019 is called It Must Be Heaven. And it takes that even more so to the extreme, in which he stars as himself as a director who is trying to make a new movie. And he almost plays this kind of like Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin type character. He doesn't speak for the whole time. He just observes and gives you this look, and it's almost like this silent, somewhat silent comedy, a bunch of vignettes about how absurd life can be in Nazareth, in Paris, and in New York, which is where he goes to try to sell his movie. And then he meets it's kind of like a meta movie. So he meets with a producer who tells him, well, your movie, you know, we feel like it's not Palestinian enough, you know, like it's like too funny. It's not serious enough, you know. So he has that sort of commentary and it's all very funny, very delightful, and also makes you think about everything that is going on and the ways in which countries are different from each other but also similar, and the way that, you know, power works and all that stuff. So definitely up my alley, and I think definitely up the alley of anyone who is into the Criterion type of stuff. Yeah. So I would recommend.
Cool. I haven't heard of that director before, so that sounds interesting.
I know, I'm so intrigued.
You guys can take advantage of the offer. I think I retreated
That's
from the
true.
Criterion.
We have an advantage over the listeners. We've still got a few days.
Yeah. Very cool. Topher, what about you? What have you been watching lately?
So in the Criterion universe, I just watched Paul Thomas Anderson's debut movie, Hard Eight, for the first time. And of course, you know, I've seen Boogie Nights, I've seen Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, all of those, The Master. But I had never seen his debut film. And it has the Paul Thomas Anderson kind of road company that we're accustomed to, you know, Philip Baker Hall and John C. Reilly, Gwyneth Paltrow. And it's just, it's so interesting to go back and see him at the beginning of his career as a storyteller, and just how sharp that dialogue is. It's just a bunch of people kind of gambling their way through Reno over the course of a few days, and then there's a time jump. But it was really, really interesting to see the beginnings of what we would later consider to be kind of his definitive style as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So that's in the Criterion world. And then everything else has just kind of been the career renaissance of Gene Smart. I have been making my way through Mayor of Easttown and Hacks on HBO Max, and getting double dose every week of the greatness that is Gene Smart. And to see a performer that has always kind of been lauded as, you know, one of the great supporting players in TV being handed a series lead with Hacks at almost age 70. And just really seeing somebody at the top of their game. Yeah. And I highly recommend her performances in both. But man, it is nice to see her front and center as she deserves to be.
She is incredible. She even did a Hallmark movie.
Yes, she did. Yes, mm-hmm. she did. Something about shoes. It was something about shoes.
So I've heard about this Mayor of Easttown, but I have not heard about this other show, Hacks.
Oh,
could you
so
guys
good.
Tell me a little bit more about that? It sounds intriguing because I love Gene Smart.
Yeah, so Gene good. Smart plays sort of the aging Joan Rivers, or in that mode. Mm-hmm. She plays like the top female comedian in Las Vegas. She has the longest running Las Vegas residency in history, hawking a bunch of stuff on QVC. And so like there's a lot of Joan Rivers parallels, right down to the plastic surgeries. And she her career is starting to take a dip, and her manager pairs her with a young comedy writer to try and kind of boost her relevancy with the millennials. And it's really mostly a two-hander between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And it ends up being, and they're just half-hour episodes. And within that, it is so trenchantly funny and has so much to say about aging and maintaining relevancy with an audience, and the experience of women in comedy. Mm-hmm. And it's it's so good.
That sounds
it's really
very good.
Yeah, I'm normally like the HBO shows aren't my favorite, just because I like more Hallmark type stuff as far as content. But I did really like Hacks. It was, I've seen the first two episodes and it was very well done. And yeah, Jean Smart, she's just incredible. I mean, to think that the same person who was the first lady on 24, which she was amazing on that show. Right. Then also, you know, in Designing Women, and she's done sitcom comedy. I mean, she's just incredible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's one of those actors you can hand her anything and then just kind of get out of her way.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good choice. Well, I got to see, it was kind of fun over the weekend. They had their first live event on Criterion Channel, and it didn't go super smoothly, but hopefully they'll keep doing more. It was the...
all out of practice, Rachel.
True. Is the Manchurian Candidate, which I had never seen. And they had Jake Tapper as the kind of the one doing the commentary along with watching it. And he is a reporter for CNN, but he also has written a book, I guess, that somehow related. I wasn't quite sure what his book was about. But anyway, that's why they tapped him, because of his book. And so as we watched, we all were chatting and on Twitter and hearing from him and other people. And so that was really fun. And I had never, like I said, never seen The Manchurian Candidate. But I had no idea how weird it is. It is a strange movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And Angela Lansbury is terrifying.
Yeah, she is. And in not that much screen time, she really does. You're like, Mrs. Potts, what is happening? there's a lot of surrealism in it. You know, there's this whole sequence where... there's this dream sequence where they're speaking in front of a bunch of military people, but then it's like a garden party with old ladies. And I don't know, it was a trippy movie. I just was not expecting, for some reason, I think maybe just because of Frank Sinatra, I was expecting it to be more like From Here to Eternity or something like that. And this was just very trippy. Hmm. Yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah.
So that was fun to get to do. I hope they do more of those. And they get some of the jitters out in the future. Mm-hmm. So
they should get us to comment on a movie next time. We'll do a good job. We'll be better than Jake Tapper. This nobody.
That's right. If you're listening, we're ready. We're ready to go.
We are available.
Yes. So that was fun. Have either of you seen, you know, The Manchurian Candidate?
Oh yeah, both versions. And I'm with you on, I love the inherent strangeness of the original. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There is something really daring that they swung for the fences on in terms of tone.
Yeah.
And really kind of capturing that sense of paranoia that you just don't expect in a movie from the early 60s, which is, you know, probably says more about my own perceptions of the storytelling of the time. But yeah, I hate it when we say things were ahead of its time. You know, things can just be good.
it kind of reminded me of Dr. Strangelove. I thought that was closest I could think to it.
Oh, I can totally see that. I can totally see that.
Yeah. Have you seen it, Conrado?
I've seen it a long time ago, and I barely remember it. Now you guys are making me really want to go and watch it again. so I'm excited. I'm glad you brought it up.
Well, it's on the Criterion Channel, so people should check it out. So very good. Well, let's dive in. Today we are talking about Roman Holiday. This is so fun.
Yay! And such a good movie for summer.
It really is. It's just such a sweet, pleasant movie. I really enjoyed rewatching it, and it's just so star-making. You can see why for Audrey Hepburn she became as big a star as she did. If you all were to come into my house, you'd see in my main sitting area, living room, I have a whole wall with posters of Audrey Hepburn movies. I don't have Roman Holiday, but I have Breakfast at Tiffany's, My Fair Lady, and Funny Face. Mm. And so I love Audrey Hepburn.
At least as a decor item, clearly.
Yeah, that's right. And I just think she just shines. She has so much charisma.
Yeah.
Yeah. In this.
That's the first thing that you're reminded of the first time her face appears on screen, and imagining, you know, this was and introducing Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah. That's right.
The delight of a camera finding her for the first time, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, and everything about her, even the way she talks, is just like a little bit unique, I think. Mm-hmm. The way she kind of pronounces words, and I don't know. I just think she has just everything about her is just unique and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And it's the persona that launched 1,000 Manic Pixie Dream Girls,
yeah.
you know? And and when you go back to Hepburn and see the authenticity of that, where it's not just like, I'm quirky, but like she's a really, there's just always something interesting mm-hmm. about her behavior, about the thought process behind a character's choices. She was a very thoughtful performer, and mm-hmm. it's so evident even in, you know, her first starring role.
I think here she is especially great, and she really transcends what you want to call like whatever Manic Pixie Dream Girl thing that some people might say, because I think the character deserves it, because she's playing a princess, right? And she, in the whole thing, is that she lives in a world that is so different and so sheltered from everything else. So her behavior makes total sense to me, that she has this different way of looking at things and being naive and, you know, about certain things, and then very smart about certain others. And I think it just fits. Also, I think she's so great at playing like people. She seems to have this regalness to her and this elegance, right? So I think she's perfect to play a princess. I actually, My Fair Lady is a movie that I am not the biggest fan of, and part of it is because at the beginning I never buy Audrey Hepburn as not you know, a perfectly well put together glamorous woman. So I'm like, no, come on, Audrey, we know you're not this, you know, woman from the gutter or whatever.
Yeah, well, a couple other things made this movie famous. First, it had an Oscar winning screenplay by Dalton Trumbo, who was blacklisted at the time. And so he wasn't able to receive the credit that he deserved. And I think that adds like an interesting sort of layer to, especially since the whole story is all about someone kind of hiding and finding who they are and everything. I think it's an interesting thing. Plus then the costumes also won an Oscar, and then Audrey Hepburn, obviously. And the whole film was filmed in Rome, which was unusual to have the entire film done abroad.
And it hits that perfect era of those travelogue romances of giving people the opportunity to experience a world different from their own. You know, there was, I read several years ago about films of the late 1940s and then moving into the early 1950s after soldiers were returning from World War II. The travelogue romance became a very popular genre because you had all of these men coming home from the Pacific Theater or from the European front who had experienced places that their family back in the States had never seen. Mm. And there was a desire to share these far-flung foreign locations that they had spent the war living in. And it was a way in setting those stories to bring that environment back.
Right.
And I thought that was really, really interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like movies like Three Coins in a Fountain are, you know, that would have been kind of your travel escapist.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. And it just adds like a lushness to this film that you wouldn't have if it was sets and, you know, things like that. There's yeah. something kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it were all done on an MGM soundstage, it would have that different feeling that I love about things that were shot entirely on an MGM soundstage, you know, where mm-hmm. it's like it becomes the pleasure that you get from seeing theater, you know.
Right.
It's the craft of creating the environment is part of the pleasure, mm-hmm. as opposed to something like this where you just get transported.
Yeah.
It's funny how it must have, you know, I feel like at the time, probably people were more used to the soundstage version of it. And then this mm-hmm. might have felt so refreshing to actually be in location in Rome. Wow. It's so glamorous. It's so realistic. It's so beautiful. And then, of course, because this movie was such a hit, and then also movies just became more into shooting on location, we started doing it so much that now if you were to do a movie all in a soundstage, it would feel more, it would stand out the way that this probably did at its time. And of course,
that's so true.
This also has the, I feel like right now it's been long enough that you watch this and it's also very much exciting because it's a time capsule of what Rome was like in the 1950s. So you get mm-hmm. to travel in time to there as well.
What do you all think about Gregory Peck in this role, him, you know, playing this kind of slightly cynical reporter, kind of character? What do you think, Topher, about Gregory Peck here?
Okay, I think Gregory Peck is perfectly cast as Joe. I am and forever will be Team Eddie Albert when it comes to Roman Holiday. That bearded hipster just like has my heart forever. I would be very, very delighted to see what would have happened if Princess Anne had taken her Roman Holiday with Eddie Albert instead. But since that's not an option, if Joe it must be, then Joe I accept. And I think Gregory Peck is everything you want out of a dashing 1950s movie star. But with a certain acerbic wit that it turns out Hepburn has the exact antidote for, which is why I think they're so well paired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think, Gerardo?
I agree with all of that. I think Gregory Peck, even though he's playing it, you know, comedically and very wittily, like Topher was saying, I think he brings a kind of severity that it's nice to see. It feels almost like a nice contradiction. You have the princess who ends up being the more carefree, charming, kind of loosey-goosey one. And then you have the reporter who is, you know, the commoner. He's the one who's like a little bit more severe, you know? So I think it brings
uptight.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So it brings a very beautiful balance, like you were saying, for sure.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of Clark Gable in It Happened One Night. I think there's similar kind of roles, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or Bringing Up Baby.
All movies that we've covered on this podcast.
We've covered a lot of screwball comedies.
A lot of starched shirt gentlemen in screwball comedies.
Because I'm a co-host of this podcast, that's why. But I agree with you also on Eddie Albert. I think that he is hilarious. Just when he keeps getting coffee thrown on him and he's like, what's going on? Well, I just think there's an innocence about her that is so sweet, you know, that as she's like getting her hair cut and getting ice cream and even like her starting off like drugged is just sort of a weird, it's almost like they had to do that in order to get her to this spot where she could have all these experiences.
I think that's the wonderful thing about Hepburn's performance is there's that she plays the longing, not for something more, but for something different. and all we're waiting for is the right catalyst to make it happen. But they do such a great job in setting up that this isn't behavior that's shockingly out of left field for the princess. All she needed was just kind of that push of circumstance to just really go for it.
Yeah, I think so. And there's just so many iconic scenes, like when the whole scene with the mouth of truth. That's one of my favorites.
I love that. I love that so much.
It's so fun. And the wall for wishes. That's a great scene.
And the Vespa chase, or not? And then honestly, the haircut. And I know we'll talk a little more about remakes and tributes to it later, but the haircut for me is a very, very significant thing with the character.
Yeah.
And particularly her just grabbing the scissors and let's do this. And it's such a small character beat in one way, but considering how much everything in her life is wrapped up in appearances. This is not just her traveling in disguise. It's her making a radical adjustment. And I love that the movie makes space for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Conrado, this is your first time watching this. So what stood out to you?
It's my first time watching it. What stood out to me, to be honest, I am just nodding along to what you guys are saying and just hearing what you have to say, because I almost feel like I just had a good time and I don't know what else to say other than it was just a fun movie, you know? It's very charming. And like we were saying, Audrey Hepburn, Gregory Peck are both great. Eddie Albert's also very funny. The guy who plays the newspaper or magazine editor, he's also very good. Hartley Power, I think it's his name. So yeah, I think it's like you say, I think it's appropriate that you are talking about these like many sequences, because it's kind of like an episodic movie, and it does a really good job of finding fun little scenes to, you know, to make up for the adventures that they have. Even the beginning, the kind of like this, when we're introduced to Anne as a princess and we see her shaking the hands of all these dignitaries, and then she kind of has to take off her shoe under her dress because it like hurts and stuff. I feel like that's such a great economic, effective way of getting us into her life, and, you know, to make us relate with a character that is so different from us.
Right.
Here, here.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the ending, because that's probably controversial. I know that when my nieces watched it, they were like, what? But I think it's one of the best parts about the movie, because it does have that little bit of sort of realism. If they had this moment together, but it would have been maybe too over the top, especially at that time. So maybe it wouldn't be as unrealistic now. But I think that the ending is really perfect. What do you think, Topher?
I couldn't agree more. I am of a mind that just because it ends doesn't mean it wasn't a love story.
Right.
So within that, you get a story of this romance that, you know, both of them emerge better because of it, that because of the time they spent together, they come out on the other side of it having grown individually. And that's the story of a lot of romances, you know, that come to their natural conclusion. And in that, I feel like it lives up to the title, that Roman Holiday is not because it's a travelogue. It's because it was kind of the exception to their existence for this precious period of time when they had this holiday together. And then holidays end and you have to return to your real life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And so I think it gives something that's otherwise really frothy and just light and delectable, like really well-made meringue, it actually gives it some weight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more with all of that. I think I agree about that, about this wants to be both, you know, a fantasy of what it would be if you hang out with the princess and, you know, you guys fell in love. But also, I think the movie, maybe partially because it wants to be this travelogue and it's taking place in the post-war era, I think it wants to have like a grounded realism to it as well, at least in terms of the emotions and the ending. I also think that there's a long tradition of like, and we all understand this idea of like a going on vacation and having this holiday a romance, right? Like you go out to vacation, you meet someone from a different country, but then it kind of has to end. You know, I feel like a lot of people have had an experience like that. So, and it's kind of fun to, and also melancholy to imagine what could have been, you know? So I think that hits really hard at the end.
Oh man, and Conrado, even as you say that, I'm connecting it back to the experience of these travelogue films and the appeal that they had for former GIs. And think about the number of them seeing this movie who had an experience exactly like that when they were away from the United States. Oh man, I just found new depth.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, let's start with our questions. We have first, what makes this a Criterion film? And I think that many of the things we talked about, but I think having a blacklisted screenwriter, I think it helps the fact that it was so acclaimed, the fact it was the start of such a icon as Audrey Hepburn. I think there's a lot of reasons why it could be part of the collection or, you know, on the Criterion Channel. What do you think, Conrado?
I think I agree with you. I think it was easy for me to see kind of all this like historical points that, like what you were saying, there's the Dalton Trumbo of it all. There's Audrey Hepburn, who this was, like you said, the beginning of her career. She also won an Oscar for this. It was a big hit movie. It was very much acclaimed. I mean, the flip side of what I said before of like I had a great time and I had a lot of fun watching the movie was that I was also wondering a little bit like what makes this movie particularly special, you know? And that was something that I was struggling to find. But after having this conversation, I think it's kind of making itself more clear to me, you know, like talking about this whole, the travelogue, the GIs coming home, the beginning of Audrey Hepburn, the distinction between the screwball comedy of the 30s and 40s. And this seems to me like a different type of romantic comedy that gives way to what comes later on. So I think that this does really feel like a capsule of something very particular, that it's like, you know, like a lot of other romantic comedies, but also unique in its own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what's great about this show is that so many times I will come in and learn more about what I've watched through the discussion. I think that's what makes it fun. Mm-hmm. But Topher, what do you think? Why do you think this deserves to be on the Criterion?
I think Trumbo, with the script, managed to tap into a very different energy than we were accustomed to seeing in romances. This is not a conflict-driven romance. This is not a fraught love story. This is, it feels very equitable between the two of them. She is so much more than just the girl. And normally the way in films from the 1940s, the way you would give a female character equal footing with her male counterpart is to kind of go the Hepburn and Tracy route, which is a little more of a sparring match. And this is, it's just so freaking breezy. But it doesn't feel insubstantial. It feels very, very character-based. It feels very lived in. And you just buy that these two are really into each other. And and having this lovely moment in time together. And we had not seen stories like that in American film up to this point. Oh. And I think it makes it very worthy of revisiting.
Mm-hmm. So we have our Criterion scale, our pretentiousness scale. And I think that this one would be about as crowd-pleasing as it gets. I mean, the only thing that maybe it is slightly challenging to the audience is maybe the ending, I guess. But I don't know. I feel like this is like a one or a two. Do you agree, Conrado?
I definitely agree. I think there is, you know, there's a lack of pretension. Just like a lot of pretension is not a bad thing, you know, like sometimes you just want to do, like Topher was saying, a beautiful taste in meringue that is completely frothy and weightless, but it also takes a lot of skill to do that, you know? So I agree mm-hmm. with you, Rachel.
Yeah.
I agree as well. Yeah. If we're going to put its kind of spiritual antecedent, Notting Hill, at a one, because Notting Hill gives us the ending that audiences are craving here, mm-hmm. Then I'm going to give it a two just because they give us something challenging with the ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So we normally do our pitches for the remake section, but in this case, we have somebody who present who did kind of slightly a remake kind of a thing. So you wrote Roman Love for Hallmark Channel, and did they come to you with this idea, or did you pitch it? How did that happen?
Yeah, they came to me. It is based on a book by Anita Hughes, and the you know, and the challenge in doing any adaptation to screen from a novel is paring down the story to its most essential elements. And that's even more tricky when you're writing for network television, because you only have 85 minutes to tell the story. And so a lot of the essential elements of the novel remained in place, but we saw the opportunity as I was working with my producer, Angela Mancuso, on developing what we were really going for. And we wanted something that felt tonally and in spirit a tribute to Roman Holiday, which is as much of a remake as I think Roman Holiday should ever have.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like for you? That must have been so intimidating.
It was, because no matter what you do, you're never going to live up to the expectations of the fan base of a beloved piece of source material. What I tried to do with Roman Love was just communicate the things that I love about Roman Holiday, and hopefully in my own fandom. And in having, we had access to some of the same locations that are used in Roman Holiday. And so we were able to do some shot setups that paid tribute to the original and some touchstone moments. But the best path forward that I could identify is approach this as a fan, communicate why you love it, and hopefully people will pick up on that affection. And mm-hmm. So that was kind of my guiding light throughout that process.
Well, I really enjoyed it. And
thank you.
We should tell people that. So it's about a woman who is hired to film the remake of Roman Holiday.
Yeah, it's right. They do a worldwide search for who is going to play the princess in the remake of Roman Holiday, because they want to follow the tradition set by the casting of Audrey Hepburn and use it as the chance to introduce audiences to a previously undiscovered talent. Mm. And our heroine, Amelia Tate, is a community theater actress in Bend, Oregon, who submits on tape and gets the role of a lifetime and comes to Rome. And the entire movie was filmed on location in Rome. The hotel suite that we used in Roman Love was the hotel suite that Audrey Hepburn stayed in while filming Roman Holiday.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so that was a fun behind the scenes bit. And then an American reporter living in Rome is assigned to write the feature story introducing her to movie-going audiences. So it's a it's Princess Anne and the reporter making their way through the streets of Rome, and in a lot of ways inadvertently retracing the steps of the characters in the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, it's a lot of fun, and I think it was very well cast with Italia Ricci and Peter Porte.
Yeah, Peter Porte, who's got kind of a little bit of a Gregory Peck mm-hmm. vibe, and Italia Ricci having that soft-spoken intelligence and wit that I really, really appreciated. And also, just by the quirks of when the movie was filmed, Italia Ricci in her kind of normal appearance on screen is more physically similar to Audrey Hepburn, very like slim featured, small of build, but she was 4 months pregnant when she filmed Rome in Love.
Oh, wow.
And, and consequently looked much more like a actress from Bend, Oregon, because, you know, she wore clothing that you can buy in stores. And, and it was an added benefit that she looked like a normal girl plucked out of obscurity. And I loved that, rather than, mm-hmm. you know, a Hollywood actress who always looks a little hungry.
Yeah.
Well, the men look hungry too. I think they're all starving.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes they're terrible about hiding the baby bumps on Hallmark. Yes. But this one was pretty good.
Was pretty successful.
Yeah, it was.
It helped that she was in Rome and could wear like a lot of peasant blouses.
Yeah.
And,
And so this will probably be the only time that we get to have somebody that's a Hallmark writer on the show. So why don't you tell us what, for somebody that's saying, oh, Hallmark movies, I'm never going to watch any of those, what would be your pitch that these sweet romances have some value to them?
Thank you sincerely for that question. I think we're in a moment, and I think it comes in waves, and I think we're coming out on the other side of cynicism being quite so in vogue. I think people have a natural suspicion of radical sincerity. Mm-hmm. That's been trained into us, thinking that there has to be an ulterior motive, or if something is radically sincere, then it lacks intelligence or purpose. The purpose of it is communicating that which is sincerely felt. Yes, you sit down to watch a Hallmark movie and you can rest assured that by the end of it, everyone's going to be just fine. And I don't know what your life is like, but there are days that I really need that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for a good story, well told. And artists who are committed to the work and committed to presenting the work without judgment. But being authentic and sincere is desperately needed, in my opinion. And I love having the opportunity to work with teams of artists who are committed to bringing that experience to an audience.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also think that while it's very important that we show the tougher and strong parts of being a woman in 2021, I also think it's really important to showcase the strength of femininity, traditional femininity, and traditional I don't know how to say this, but that it's important that side is powerful as well. That you don't have to be a kick butt woman in order to be a kick butt woman.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a identifying with the LGBTQ community, I have a lot of conversations about if we really say that every choice that you can make for a life authentically lived, where you seek not to harm anyone else, if we're saying that all of those choices across the spectrum are valuable, then we have to mean exactly that. And yes, the female leads in Hallmark movies tend to skew towards a certain type of presentation, how they dress, their way of being in the world. And if we're going to say that all authentic presentations of self have value, then we have to include that as well. Not everything has to be Breaking Bad. And I say that as a huge fan of Breaking Bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. That's very well said. And I just want to add to what you were saying that the whole point of the Criterion Project as a show was for us to catch up with movies that we have meant to see for a long time, to try out new stuff. And I think someone listening to the Criterion Project, for them, watching a Hallmark movie might be an adventurous thing to do, you know, and something new. Yeah. So why not try it?
Yeah. Yeah, you just might be surprised. And if you want guidance on what to watch, check out the Hallmarkies podcast.
Yeah. Or just check out my IMDb page. Yeah, that's whatever right. You need. Yeah. I'll get you started.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. Well, this has been so much fun. I really enjoyed talking about this movie and getting to talk with you, Topher. But Conrado, what are we going to be talking about next?
Yeah, so next time for something completely different, we're going to go to Belgium, the movie Rosetta, which is the kind of breakthrough movie for the brothers Luc and Jean-Pierre Dardenne, who are favorites at the Cannes Film Festival. So, you know, very Criterion-y. Perhaps very pretentious, who knows, we'll see. This is a movie that won the Palme d'Or and it's very well reviewed and regarded, so I'm excited to see it because I've never seen it, so I want to give it a try and see what's up.
I never even heard of it until you mentioned it, so it'll be a good one. It'll be a good one. Well, Topher, if people want to follow you on social media and all that fun stuff, how can they do that?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Topher Payne, TOPHERPAYNE. And I'm on Instagram at Topher Writes, like Topher Writes Stuff. And then my website, topherpayne.com.
Great. And make sure you're following us at Criterion Pod on Twitter as well. And Conrado, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at CocoHitsNY. I am also on Instagram and Letterboxd if you guys are into that with the same name. So you can find me there as well.
Great. And you can find me at Rachel's Reviews, all of our social media, iTunes, YouTube, and on Rotten Tomatoes. Check that out. And also check out the Hallmarkies podcast. We have a lot of fun over there. So take a look at that. And thanks so much. And we will be back for Rosetta next episode. So thanks again, Topher. And we'll talk to y'all later. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, y'all.
See ya.